So today we're thinking about God's wisdom. And this comes in the context of the book of Job, which we have been looking at over a number of weeks. Some of you might have seen the old comedy movie called Bruce Almighty, where Bruce, played by Jim Carrey, felt that God was not treating him well. His life was going all out of control, and despite asking God for help, he felt his prayers were not being answered. And so, in one scene in the movie, he let rip and let God know just how he felt about the unfairness of everything. And boldly he stated, "I could do a better job than you." And in response, Morgan Freeman, who played God, so God decided to go on holiday and leave Bruce in charge. And in one scene, Bruce found himself overwhelmed by the prayers he was hearing. He was trying to go off to sleep, but he kept hearing these voices asking him for things, one after the other, more and more on top of each other. And so he decided that he would try to order these prayers by putting them on sticky notes. And so he ordered this, and all of a sudden, a sticky note appeared and another one appeared, and then flap, 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 all around the room. All the walls, the computer, everything were covered in these prayers as prayer upon prayer upon prayer kept coming in and feeling swamped by all of these prayers. And feeling he had no time to answer each of them separately, he just decided to say yes to everything. Yes, that'll make it easy. Yes. But this meant, instead of having one very happy lotto player winning millions, there were millions who prayed to win the lottery, all winning, but finding the prize shared among so many meant they had received practically nothing at all. Their prayer to win the lottery was answered, but not in a meaningful way. And so one of the little insights of this movie was that prayer, just a small part of sort of what God thinks deals with, is far too complex for any human being to be able to see or know or understand. And this, in a sense, is where we find Job arriving in these passages. Job's heart is in the right place, but his knowledge is lacking. And he doesn't have the ability to understand God's ways. He doesn't have the depth or the breadth to be able to perceive what God does. He can't comprehend the what's and why's of his own situation, let alone understand the things in the wider world which are in God's care. And so as we've been looking at the book of Job, one of the big issues, one of the big themes that we find there is that of suffering. And when we think about that, we need to see that against the background of our broken world. There is, in a sense, chaos and randomness in our lives. So life is unpredictable. Last month, a tornado struck in Auckland. If people had known that was coming their way, they might have been able to prepare, but they simply didn't know. Similarly, there's been flooding on our west coast, flooding in Europe, heat waves in North America. And last week on the news, some of you would have seen the frightening images in China of an underground railway system where the water just started rising and rising and rising up to people's chests, up to their shoulders, above the head height of children who had to be held up, and they had to stand there for hours and hours waiting to be rescued. If they had known that was going to happen, they would not have got onto those trains. They would have made other arrangements. If we could see into the future, we could avoid offense like these. But we don't know the random events that are going to happen day by day. And also there's a fragility to our lives. We are frail. We can feel quite strong. We can do so much with our bodies, but stub your toe and you soon cry out. Get sick and you're soon in bed. And we have difficulties at times with mental health or natural aging. Humans are frail. And added to the suffering in our world, humanity inflicts a lot of unnecessary suffering on ourselves, with greed and anger and envy and pride motivating us to act selfishly. We do things that are wrong, which hurt ourselves and often end up hurting others. And humanity, we find ourselves in our lives constrained and limited, lacking wisdom, lacking foresight, lacking abilities. Even when we do our best, sometimes even our best has unexpected consequences, sometimes that can hurt others or have harmful outcomes. Donald Rumstead once said, "There are known knowns. We know there are also known unknowns, but there are also unknown unknowns." And part of humanity's problem is we have absolutely no idea about the unknown unknowns. And so much of that will come upon us. We don't know why when Adam and Eve sinned, God didn't rectify that situation straight away, send Jesus. But if he had, probably you and I wouldn't be here. We don't know why God has chosen to work out salvation over so many thousands of years, or when indeed the Father will say, time's up, and now Christ will return. We don't know why this is all taking so much time. And because it does take time, there have been many wars with millions of casualties and worldwide pandemics like the one we are in at the moment, but there have been others before us, and many people have died. We see the fractured nature of our world exacerbated by human decisions that impact on things like climate change and global warming. We see the resulting flooding and the fire that destroys homes and takes lives. In one sense, I know this doesn't make total sense, but just bear with me. In one sense, what would things be like if God had said, well, you can do whatever you like. You can do whatever you please. There'll be no earthly consequences. You won't have any pain. You won't have any sickness and no death, and no suffering. What would such a world look like if humanity was just able to go on unbridled doing whatever it is we wanted to do? And if there was a world without suffering, how would Jesus have come to suffer for us and take our place so that we might have our relationship with God restored? Some of these things are just so complex. I've printed out a bulletin, in the bulletin, five theological ways that people use to explain suffering. Job and his friends seem pretty fixated on number one. Suffering is divine punishment. But I give you that list and I invite you perhaps to sit down somewhere this afternoon and take a look through it and think about it. You know, in one circumstance, one of these things might be more true or real for you. In another circumstance, it might be one of the others, or it might be a mix of several of these things. But what we find as we think about this is it is very, very complex. The deeper we look, the more variables we find, the greater our confusion. When it comes to understanding suffering, there is no easy answer. So what have we found in the book of Job during this series on Sundays? Well, right at the beginning of Job, we'll remember that God said that Job was blameless. But also recall, we differentiated, blameless is not sinless. Job had sinned, but you remember Job was very careful with God, with sacrifices and the like, and he kept his relationship with God going well. So God declared him blameless. When we looked at this, we found it was God and his policies that were on trial, not Job. So Satan's accusation is that God's policy of blessing people who do what is right is actually causing problems because Job would not worship him. This is Satan's logic. Job would not worship God if God was not constantly blessing him for all the things. And so Satan was saying to God, it's your fault. It's your policies of blessing that are at fault. We also found life is unfair. And what appeared to Job to be a random series of events, livestock stolen, lost, his children die in a terrible storm. Life is unfair, and we just know this in our own lives. Things happen that just shouldn't, but they do. And we find that Job's friends are unwise. They figure on what the scholars call the retributive principle, where if you do what is right, God must bless you. If you do what is wrong, God must punish you. And because they saw Job suffering, they determined that is God's punishment, therefore you must have sinned and done wrong. But they're mistaken. In this, we also know that Job discovers, and I think this is really at the heart of this book, that he needs a mediator. He's not going to find out who this mediator is. We find out later in the New Testament the mediator that God sends. But Job knows he needs a mediator because he can't get an audience with God. And in a sense, and at the heart of this book, the deepest answer to suffering is not knowing the reason why any particular instance of suffering comes, but knowing God and having a relationship with God. And this is what we see in Job from start to finish. He has this relationship with God. He goes through this period of suffering. He gets confused by it. He doesn't know what is going on. But then in the end, God restores him. And as God speaks towards the end, speaks of Job as have spoken truth about God. So we come to these closing chapters of Job with all of these things in mind, and God does come to speak, but doesn't answer Job's questions quite as Job thought he would. A momentary aside. Last week, we talked about Job's complaints, we mentioned Lamentations, we spoke about some of the Psalms in which people are sort of so upset by the things that are happening around them, they cry out to God and lamenting and complaining and asking God, what on earth is going on? I don't understand what is happening here. And we know from the scripture, it's quite all right for us to do that. God knows us. God understands us. He sees us as we are. But I should have put a little bit of a warning in the fine print of that message, because sometimes when God responds, he doesn't do it exactly as we think he might. And sometimes, perhaps as happens here with Job, he brings a challenge and we find God rebuking Job. So God's opening words towards the end of this book grab our attention. The Lord spoke to Job out of a storm. He said, who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man and I will question you and you shall answer me. And the first thing we note there is that God is speaking out of a storm. Sometimes, and the way we like it to be, is that when we hear the gentle voice of God speaking to us, That's sort of, in a sense, one of the best things, that God would speak to us gently and in a comforting sense. But here, God is speaking out of a storm, sometimes translated as whirlwind. This isn't the gentle whisper speaking softly in the stillness of the green pastures. This is God blasting forth. This is like the cloud, the lightning when Moses climbed Mount Sinai. The sign of God's power, the sign of God's glory. There's something awesome and chaotic about a storm. It puts you on your guard. If you can, you take shelter from the storm. Job may have been seeking, in a sense, a reasonable, logical debate in a court with clear rules, but instead he finds God talking to him away in a way that is almost, he's almost in danger of being swept away by this whirlwind. You know, when we are suffering, when we are in pain, we're not in a tranquil, calm, reasonable place. So often we feel tossed about physically and emotionally as if we ourselves are in a storm. And so in a sense it's apt that in the storm God would speak to us and speak out of this storm. Powerful, unpredictable. And God says to Job, "Who is obscuring my plans?" In other translations, it says, "Who's this that darkens my counsel?" Job's speech had started to go a little wayward. He was obscuring the truth that God wanted people to know. He was casting a shadow over what God was doing. What had he done? He was protesting his innocence. Why was that a wrong thing to do? Because God had already declared him blameless. And so God had said, Job is blameless, but Job keeps declaring his innocence. But he's off track. That's not what this is about. He's misguided. The scholar John Walton wrote, "It's no surprise that Job would be confused because he lacked knowledge. What is unacceptable is that he spoke as if he did have knowledge. For this he is reprimanded." He's sort of speaking as if he has this knowledge that God is punishing me, but I'm innocent. If only I had a chance to talk to God, I could clear all this up. And so as I mentioned in that list in the bulletin, it seems that Job, just like his friends, was thinking this is divine punishment, and that's obscuring what's really happening here, casting a shadow over it. The punishment explanation makes suffering and blessings appear to be solely a matter of justice or injustice. But God is not some sort of computer mechanically programmed to be a justice machine. God isn't bound by some sort of cosmic list. 10 lies will be punished by a stub toe. However, if you cut your neighbor's berm, you will be rewarded by finding $5 in the gutter. God doesn't sort of robotically dispense justice in this way. In a different context, we read, and I know I'm taking this slightly out of context, "What then shall we say? Is God unjust? Not at all. For he says to Moses, 'I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion.'" And the reason that I turn to this is because it underlines God's sovereignty, God's freedom to act not like we expect, but just according to his own plans and his own purposes. And so we read in Isaiah, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." And there's just such a vast gap between the way God thinks and the way humanity thinks. Our thoughts fall so far short of what God is thinking. But if you understand this, if you recognize that God doesn't think like we think, then that will help you to understand what God is saying to Job. And you know, when God says to Job, "Brace yourself like a man," that things aren't going to work out quite the way Job had been hoping. Again, as we come to these passages, and we've just taken some verses, I invite you to read them through in full yourself, you'll find that there's a poetic nature to what is being said here. It's ancient Hebrew poetry. And so what God is saying is based on the ancient understanding of the created order that Job would understand in his thinking. And so there's a verse that says, it speaks about taking the earth by the edges and shaking the wicked off it. It's almost like cleaning a carpet in the olden days, shaking it to get rid of all the dirt. Now, people who think the earth is flat might enjoy that verse, but really, it's sort of like a poetic imagery, not modern scientific fact. And so God in these passages is describing creation, the earth, the sea, the light, the darkness, the rain, the snow, the stars in the sky, the lions, the ravens, the goats, and so much more. And then God stops and says to Job, were you there when these were made? Did you set the boundaries? Surely you know. Surely you comprehend all this. And God rounds this off saying to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. And Job comes to a stop in a sense. He ceases protesting his innocence, and he comes to God with more a sense of humility. And the second time, God tells Job to brace himself. God asks, will you discredit my justice? Are you clothed in glory? Are you clothed in majesty? Are you shining in the radiance of God? And then God draws on the images of two great creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan. And while Behemoth resembles a hippopotamus and Leviathan resembles a crocodile, there are some of the poetic aspects in these passages that are beyond the natural creatures that we know, such as breathing fire. The first set of questions that God is bringing to Job is saying, what have you made? Were you there at creation? Were you sorting it out? Were you setting the boundaries? But the second set of questions says to Job, okay, it's clear you haven't created anything, but what can you do with the creatures who are already here? If he cannot create a beast, can he at least subject it to his will and make it do his bidding? And so God speaks of these two creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan. These are not household pets. These cannot be tamed. These are dangerous animals. These creatures answer to God, but Job can't do anything with them. And in this, we notice God hasn't answered Job's questions about suffering. Instead, he's trying to give Job perspective. Job, creation is vast. You don't even know where to find wisdom. You lack power and insight. You're speaking without knowledge. And so Job responds knowing that. Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things that are too wonderful for me to know. George Bernard Shaw is reported to have said, if I complain that I'm suffering unjustly, it's no answer to say, can you make a hippopotamus? Now, Shaw, in his sarcasm, misses what Job, in his repentance, understood. This is not about making a hippopotamus. This is about humbly recognizing our limitations. Here, Job recognizes his own inadequacies as a human. He can't understand what God understands. He can't see what God sees. He can't make what God makes. For Job, the deep answer to the question of how to cope with his suffering is not knowledge, but relationship. Relationship with God. God whose hand he can take. God who will be with him through the suffering. Now, we may not have the answers to why we suffer. In reality, we may not even really know the right questions to ask God. But we can be in a right relationship and take the hand of God who knows it all. Adam and Eve's mistake was to forsake their relationship with God to gain knowledge. God's desire is for that relationship to be restored to us. In that relationship, he can help to carry us through our suffering and through our pain. So what are we to make of this? We know the world is broken, humanity is fallen, creation is groaning. In the midst of this, we are made in such a way that if we're cut, we bleed, we feel the pain. We're emotional beings, we're vulnerable, we have joy, we have sorrow. Our minds, as amazing as they are limited, and our lack of understanding can cause us frustration. Sometimes in our mental health, we're subject to highs, we're subject to lows. Our bodies age, can be broken, susceptible to illness. I've given you those points again. I mentioned them in the bulletin. When you're in the middle of pain, you're not going to think, oh, just a minute, I'll get that list. That list is, in a sense, useless when we're in the midst of our pain. When we're suffering, we don't think about those sorts of things. What we need at that point is the hand of God to help us through. When we think about the book of Job and what it teaches about suffering, one of the key things that we need to remember is that Job was written in a very early ancient time. And Job, while true, doesn't have all the answers. We know more because we have the New Testament and we know about Christ. And he came to us and said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke on you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. You will find rest for your souls." He said to his disciples, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you." And the Apostle Paul was inspired to write about God being the Father of all compassion, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles. And when you read about these things, in a sense we know more than Job knew. And in that relationship we have opportunity to have the peace, to know the rest, to find the compassion that God will bring to us. We need all of this, all of these insights that Jesus gave to us. And so I pray as we come to the end of this series, you might find yourselves better equipped to deal with whatever suffering may come to you. Because of what God has done through Jesus Christ, we can have faith even in a world of suffering, and even when that suffering comes to us. And even when that suffering is great, I do not say that lightly. I do not say that lightly at all. But in the midst of our darkest times, the thing we need most is the hand of God with us. There's an old saying, "I don't know what the future holds, but I know who holds the future." And we know God who holds the future. Not only does he hold that, but he holds us. We read, "The eternal God is your refuge. And underneath are the everlasting arms." We may not always feel it. We may not always be aware. But at any time and every time, God's everlasting arms are under us. And the promise of Christ is not vain. "Surely I am with you always, even to the very end of the age." Amen.